Hi, I'm Jeremy Redleaf, the co-writer, co-director, co-star, and producer of Third Street Blackout, and you are watching Mr. Media.
I'm Bob Andelman, and this is Mr. Media Interview. You can see, hear, and read more than 1,000 of my previous celebrity interviews at MrMedia.com. That's MRMedia.com. Subscribe to the show on YouTube, iTunes, Apple News, Google Play, or Stitcher, and follow us on Twitter or Facebook. On today's show, I'll welcome back Jeremy Redleaf, writer, director, and star of a new indie romantic comedy, Third Street Blackout. This is Jeremy's second time on the show. His first appearance was as director of a three-minute parody film, Juno, which arrived in October 2008, just in time to tweak Sarah Palin. It's a story of a pregnant teen named, wait for it, Bristol. Stick around. Redleaf has done so much cool stuff since then that Juno isn't even on his bio anymore. Whatever happens in a blackout stays in a blackout. But eventually, secrets about things that happened before the blackout are likely to escape the cone of silence. Third Street Blackout is a romantic comedy written by Nurgen Farsad and Jeremy Redleaf. It is directed and produced by Farsad and Redleaf. It also stars, you guessed it, Farsad and Redleaf. She is a foul-mouthed, often hysterically funny Iranian-American comedian, filmmaker of the documentary The Muslims Are Coming, and author of How to Make White People Laugh. He is the man behind a transmedia production company, I gotta find out what that means, called Brackets Creative, is a creative consultant on Fuse, Funny or Dies, Billy on the Street, and as an actor plays Gonigan on Sesame Street and narrates Guy Code, Guy Court, and Jobs That Don't Suck for MTV. Now, I don't know if that's Jobs That Don't Suck or Jobs That Don't Suck at MTV, but we'll save that for another time. By the way, Third Street Blackout features cameos from comedians Janine Garofalo, John Hodgman, Rachel Feinstein, and features a very funny supporting turn by Phyllis Somerville, who you may recognize most recently from Daredevil on Netflix, or my favorite, as neighbor Marlene from Showtime's The Big C. She was great in that.
Mm-hmm.
Jeremy Redleaf, welcome back to Mr. Media.
Oh, man, so happy to be here. I noticed before you called this a celebrity interview. Does that mean that I'm now officially a celebrity?
Oh, you're big-time celebrity,
yes.
My friend. You are a celebrity. You got celebrity written all over you.
Oh, man, thank you.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you know, when this interview is over, you may lose that status, but coming in, definitely celebrity
For the
status.
Next 20 minutes, I'm going to feel like a celebrity.
You are. You absolutely are. So how is it that – and by the way, am I pronouncing your leading lady's name right? Is it Nurgen?
You're not, but no one has ever pronounced it correctly.
Tell me.
It's a Nagin Farsad.
Nagin Farsad.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
All right. I should have asked you that before we started. But
oh, no problem.
All right, Nagin. I'm very, very sorry. I will try not to get it wrong now.
She forgives you.
Thank you. Thank you. How is it that you guys wrote this movie? You directed and produced it. You star in it. But you gave all the best lines to a 15-year-old named Chuck.
Because we're generous people. that was the big challenge was like, you know, we were in this movie, we're writing this movie. We always had to think about what was best for the movie, not necessarily what's best for us. And often that meant, giving the lines to spreading them around.
Well, you know, it's really interesting, too, because you guys star in the film. You're clearly the center of the film. And in this type of independent, you know, smaller film, it tends to be that the supporting cast doesn't really get a lot of moments. There's just not much for them to do. But here between Chuck – what's the actor's name who plays Chuck?
Miles J. Harvey.
Miles J. Harvey. Nice work, kid. And Phyllis Somerville and then Janine Garofalo. I mean, they get some good stuff to do in the film. It's nice.
Yeah, I mean, it's a movie about New York, and we wanted to show New York and you know have it in, hire all our friends and really build this world and that's not always possible on a small budget. The reason why most indie films don't have it is because they just can't afford, you know, to fill rooms and things like that. So, but we managed to make it work.
So the question I got to ask you, because I just don't know. I tried to find the answer so I wouldn't have to ask.
Mm-hmm.
You guys wrote the film together, directed, produced, starred. Okay. You have great chemistry together. Are you a couple? I mean
– We're not a couple. Oh. We both actually got engaged after making the film. So I think the lesson there is that making an indie film makes you an adult. It makes you makes you ready to commit to someone that's cool.
Interesting. Interesting. Yeah. Well, you guys pull it off very well. You're an odd yet interesting couple together.
As all couples should be.
Yeah. So what was the? How did this come about? How did the collaboration come about? How do you wind up writing a whole movie together?
Yeah, so we met a couple years ago. We're all comedy duo start in Minneapolis, of all places. We were at a conference together, and we bonded because there was nothing else to do. And then we came back to New York, and we started helping each other out with a couple of small projects. And one December, we ran into each other, and we were just lamenting about how long things take, you know, to do them through the studio system. And wouldn't it be great if we could just put together a movie that was small and doable and quick? And for some reason that stuck, and we actually did it. You know, you have those conversations and they never happen, but for some reason this one happened. So we started writing it together, and it just never stopped.
Now the thing that makes this movie happen is that there's a hurricane that hits New York and wipes out power to a big section of Manhattan where you guys live. What a coincidence! Did you plot this before or after Sandy? And you know, was there any? Did either of you have to be in the city when Sandy hit?
Yeah, we were both in the blackout zone for Sandy. Nikki was on 3rd Street of all places, and I was on 39th Street. We both had really crazy experiences during the blackout. For her, she was about to break up with a guy, and the blackout made everything more romantic, and they sort of got a second wind. And for me, it was the first time I met my neighbors. It turned out I have awesome neighbors, and I just never, you know, found a reason to introduce myself. So, you know, it was this 5-day period of where everyone was forced to be different, forced to be a little more analog and community-based. And it turns out that New York has this whole other side of it that never gets to be seen. So we wanted to show that on screen.
Well, I was just going to say, yeah, I mean, Phyllis Somerville is a good her character is a good example of that, in that your character already knows her and is very chummy with her, and Nagin's character doesn't remember anything about her, you know, and that has some real nice organic moments in the film. Yeah, no, it's very sweet.
And Nagin would want me to tell you that in real life she's totally involved in her community, and she's and in real life, you know. So the movie takes place on 3rd Street. Nagin lives on 3rd Street. She plays a TED speaker in the movie. She is a TED speaker. So we have big imaginations, but you know, they say, right, what do you know?
Well, I was going to ask you about the TED thing. They've almost become ubiquitous. I mean, there's so many TED Talks around the country. There's so many people who have done TED Talks. She panics at the beginning because she's about to go on, and the person out there just has all these warm, you know, anecdotal moments. And it's just it just seems like the TED Talks are pretty ripe for satire at this point.
Yeah, we're the first. They've shown up in some TV shows, but I think as far as I know, we're the first movie to be able to bring that world to screen. And it was just really fun to satirize it. You know, Nagin obviously had a lot of first-hand experience to draw on.
I worry that the two of you as a duo will never be invited now.
it's a concern. It's a serious concern. But you know, art must happen.
I got it. Was this the first time you had a co-carry a movie like this?
First time collaborating in such a partner kind of way. Yeah, it was a real learning experience. And you know, it's really when you're the thing about directing that most people like is that you get to make the decisions. And when you're working with someone else, you have to, you know, it's a negotiation. It's like a relationship. You have to really, practice, you know, cutting through all the things that get couples caught up and hone in on what's important. So it was just like a really great exercise in being a functioning adult in the world.
Well, and I mean, this is the second time we've talked. The first time was like 8 years ago. Yeah. So I can't say that I have any insight into you as a person at all. But it's interesting that, I mean, talking to you here when we spoke years ago, you come across as very confident. You have a good voice for doing, you know, voiceover, that kind of thing. But your character on screen, I mean, Nagin's character is very strong and very strong-willed, if you will. Your character is kind of like fades back and doesn't want to believe too much could happen. And, you know, it's just kind of a little mousy maybe. Was that difficult for you to play, or was it easy to let go in that regard?
No, it was difficult to find the version of that worked on screen. You know, that it's been part of my arc as a growing up is to come out of my shell and to get rid of limiting beliefs and to be able to step into going for it and taking risks and you know, failing. So, you know, I had a lot to draw on, but you know, it's another thing to show a version on that on screen that people respond to. And so that was really the dance with it. But yeah, so, you know, you don't get to see a lot of, you know, main characters in this kind of movie that are just like their own obstacle, really. You usually see an external obstacle. We wanted to see what would it be like if the only thing stopping him was himself.
Hmm. What about the music in the film? It's got a great soundtrack.
Oh, thanks. Yeah.
Who chose the music and what were you kind of going for there?
Yeah. So Nagin worked with our composer Gabi Alter on our previous documentaries, "The Muslims Are Coming" and "Nerdcore Rising," and she brought him to the table, and he just crushed it. He really turned moments that weren't working into moments that were working. And then, you know, after we composed the score, we went out to local indie bands and begged them to let us use their music. And a couple of them were kind enough to hop on board. So, yeah, Nagin has great music taste and I love music. And, you know, together we figured out a score that you know, people seem to love.
And did you guys self-finance this or did you go out for financing? What's the route?
We stole all the money. We're actually on the lam right now. I'm in the islands, Cayman Islands, doing this interview.
It does look like a temporary place behind you. So.
Yeah. We're in the back of a post office. We raised the money through equity financing. We went after. We both know a bunch of people in New York, and we told her, you know, this is what we're going to do. And, you know, 15 people hopped on board, and it was pretty amazing. You know, when we finished the movie, we had to, you know, you always need a little extra. So we went to Kickstarter and raised a little more money. And surprisingly, more people hopped on board. So now we're up to 500 people that have helped bring this movie together. So it's been a pretty amazing experience.
And the budget was?
Less than a house in the middle of nowhere.
Less than a house in the middle of nowhere. All right, folks, you go look that up. I'm not going to look that up. Another thing that was interesting to me about the film was actually the treatment of texts. That's T-E-X-T-S, mostly at the beginning, a little bit later as well. They almost become like a character because the way they show up, and there's actually pauses as the letters pop up on the screen. Just deciding to have some fun with that, or...
Well, you know, you see, you know, the way people used to show text in movies, it was just like a extreme close-up of a phone, and like that's not a super interesting frame. So we, you know, in the last couple of years, you've seen a couple of TV shows mostly. I think House of Cards was one of the first ones to do it, saying what would it look like if the texts were out in the world and you could see people's reactions to them. And so we had, you know, we stood on the shoulder of some giants, but we said, you know, how can we make this unique? What can we, you know, how can we make this our version? So we worked with a Brazilian company that does amazing work, and they're called SoPro, and they helped us. They helped us find a look for our texts and our media on screen. And because it's a movie about text and media, we thought it would be interesting to sort of bring it into the world.
Makes sense. Jeremy, I'm curious. Your resume has gotten much broader and more interesting over these 8 years. What is your primary vocation this year? I mean, writer, actor, producer, pickle enthusiast, Dr. Ruth video wrangler. Tell me. where is your focus?
Do I have to pick one? Yeah, if I did, it would be pickles. No. I enjoy being a multi-hyphenate, and every day it makes every day exciting because every day I wake up with a new challenge. So, you know, I'm finishing up this movie, and I just wrote a new movie, and I'm also doing a new show for MTV, and I'm developing a virtual reality show. So I just like to, you know, I still like to always be learning and moving forward. So there's not really one thing that I'm the most excited about, but I am getting ready to direct another movie that I got hired to direct off of this. So that's the next big project.
Oh, congratulations.
Yeah, thanks.
So can you figure out a way that next time we do an interview, we can use a Google Cardboard and do it all in VR?
Absolutely. We'll have like full size replicas of each other.
That would be weird. Okay, that would be kind of weird. All right, folks, you can watch Third Street Blackout, written, directed, produced, co-written, co-directed, co-produced, and co-starring Nagin Farsad.
That's right.
Okay.
That was right.
Nikki Firsad. And Jeremy Redleaf, my guest here today. It's available on video on demand, which would be what these days? iTunes?
So, cable operators, iTunes, Google Play, Vudu, wherever fine movies are purchased in the digital age.
Perfect. Perfect. And where can people find you? Is there a website for the film? Is there Twitter, Facebook?
We're on all the platforms. I'm The Leaf is Red on all platforms. That's my last name, the Red Leaf. The Leaf is Red, and yeah, come say hi.
Nice. All right. Well, Jeremy Redleaf, great to see you. Great to have you back. Maybe when you get your MTV show going or whatever the next film, I hope you'll come back before 8 years is up.
And Bob, I would love to be back every day. You tell me when and I'll be there.
I don't know about every day.
We can make this interesting every day of the week,
well,
I'm pretty sure.
If it was virtual reality and we had some, you know, some dancing girls or something.
Maybe.
Give
true.
That some thought. But yeah.
All right, maybe once a week.
All right, once a week. I would do that. Sure,
right.
I would do that.
You have a hard bargain.
Listen, congratulations on the movie. It's a lot of fun. And thanks for joining us, Mr. Media, today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Recorded live before a studio audience full of hurricane blackout survivors who believe the power will be back on any minute now in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida.